Good afternoon, everyone. I am not Jeff Dowdy. I am Barbara Bigby. I am the Chief Deputy of the Department of Real Estate, and as of Monday, I am also the Acting Real Estate Commissioner. Thank you. Jeff Dowdy has left us, returning to the business in the Monterey Bay Area. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the executive team. To my immediate left is Wayne Bell, our chief counsel, and my lawyer. To his left is Lisa Stratton, our administrative assistant. To my right is Bill Moran, assistant commissioner for enforcement. Going down the line is Tom Poole. He has a very long title. Bear with me. Assistant Commissioner for Legislation, Public Affairs, and Mortgage Lending Activities. Next to Tom, we have Dan Sondry, the Chief of Audits. And then we have Steve Ellis, Assistant Commissioner for Administrative Services and Licensing. And last but certainly not least is Chris Neary, the Assistant Commissioner for the Subdivision Program. Because we're in Sacramento today, we also have several members of our Sacramento staff in the audience. I'd like for them just to stand. I'm not going to introduce them because we have quite a contingent, and be recognized now. So if you guys would stand. It's good to have support. Well, as I said, it finally has happened. By now, you've probably heard that Jeff Dowdy, the 22nd real estate commissioner, has returned home to practice real estate in the Monterey Bay Area after serving nearly 6.5 years with DRE. While we will all miss his spark, his enthusiasm, and his leadership, he did leave us with a roadmap for DRE's future. That is contained within our 5-year strategic plan. The plan came together through a choir of voices at the DRE and represents our collective objectives as well as how we plan to monitor and measure our success. It is through this plan that improvement and advancements will be achieved. As acting commissioner, I view my role as one of a guardian of the department, orchestrating the day-to-day operations and continuing the collective pursuit of the objectives as they are in the plan, as well as the directives of the administration. It is not my intention to introduce sweeping changes. In fact, I am proud to say that our department has a clear direction that is consistent with the vision of the administration, and we will endeavor to keep those high standards and performance objectives, strengthening and refining our professional effectiveness. DRE has emerged as a standard of good government, and with a strategic plan as a guide, we have a strong sense of purpose and an incentive to succeed. One of the main focuses of the strategic plan is succession planning, and that is with good reason. The department has been and will continue to face the retirements of many long-term employees in the months and years to come. It is a fact that many good people come to work for us and stay for life. A somewhat alarming statistic is that approximately 40% of our workforce are in the twilight of their career, and the majority of those are in specialized jobs or in management positions. In April alone, we celebrated with 4 of our comrades as they retired, and as a group, they represented 120 years of service to this department. That's a lot of institutional knowledge and expertise going out the door. But we expected this to happen, and the focus of our strategic plan will help us address succession planning. Succession planning is all about taking the apprehension out of the unknown that lies ahead while assuring that the business operations of the organization continue. To that end, we are finalizing a comprehensive program that has been coined the DRE Institute. That includes training, mentorship, and leadership development so that we are prepared to face the eventualities and the many challenges that lie ahead of us as more of us hit the road in retirement. As to the timing of the appointment of the 23rd real estate commissioner, frankly, your guess is as good as mine. The administration is facing many critical priorities, starting with the state budget and it may be some time before a real estate commissioner appointment is actually made. If that is the case, rest assured that the DRE, we are prepared to move forward following our plan. And now, if you'll bear with me, I'll put on my other hat and give you the operations report. We will begin by addressing the department's fiscal situation. You may wish to refer to the statistical handout in the back of the room, which was made available to you as you came in. This first slide represents the same information breakdown as in your handout dealing with the monthly revenue, net expenditures, and reserve balances for the first three quarters of fiscal year 2010-11. Today's report will focus on comparing statistical information for July through March of 2009-10 with those same months in the current fiscal year of 2010-11. Let's start by reviewing a comparison of each of these fiscal categories. Revenue received increased by 20% from $30 million in 2009-10 to $35.9 million in 2010-11. Net expenditures were also up by 19% from $25 million in 2009-10 to $29.8 million in fiscal year 10-11. This increase is mainly attributable to the addition of 27 new positions needed to process mortgage loan originator license applications and perform the necessary background checks. The DRE reserve balance increased by 23%, from $27 million in 2009-10 to $33 million as of March 31st, 2011. As I said, these increases in revenue, expenditures, and reserves during this reporting period are mainly a result of the new MLO license endorsement program. Later in today, Tom Poole will provide you an update on the MLO license statistical information and our enforcement progress with that program. As to the licensing workload, down. Again, we are comparing July through March of 2009-10 with July through March of 2010-11. We find that all licensing reporting statistical categories are in the decline over the prior year. Salesperson examination applications dropped by 11%, or 2,471 fewer exam applications. Broker examination applications are also down by 16%, with 1,564 fewer applications. The numbers of original licenses issued dropped following the lower examination numbers, with salesperson licenses issued down by 1%, or 136, when compared to a year ago. The number of broker licenses fell 11%, or 606 license applications from the prior year. Renewals. While the percentage of salesperson licenses renewing remained constant at 60%, the actual number of licensees renewing dropped by 4,247. The percentage of brokers renewing dropped by 2 percentage points from 78% to 76%, with 1,008 fewer brokers renewing their licenses over the prior year. And as we make the fiscal year comparison of the license population total, the number of licensees dropped by 7%, as shown in your handout. However, despite the long and steady decline in our license population, the total still remains higher than in 4-5. With 457,350 licensees as of March 31st. The total number of licensees this morning was 453,930. The decline is continuing. As to subdivisions, subdivision filing activity continued to climb, contributing toward the increase in our revenue. The July through March comparisons of the two fiscal years illustrate that final public reports are up by 5%, with subdivision renewal reports up by 52%. By contrast, the number of amendments to existing projects declined by 39%. This statistical shift in applications points to now a prolonged trend of new growth and possible resurgence in housing developments. So we're glad to see that. enforcement continues to concentrate on consumer protection and investigating complaints. Again, comparing the first 9 months of 9-10 with the same time period in 10-11, we find that with the continuing low number of original license applications, background checks, which could lead to license denials, are down by 70. The percentage, though, of outright license denials remain pretty consistent between the 2 years at 64%. Disciplinary actions show an increase of 46. In 2010-11, the department is taking more and tougher enforcement actions than in previous years and is revoking licenses at a record pace. As example, of the 694 total disciplinary actions taken thus far in 2010-11, 512 represent revocations of existing licensees. That's roughly 74% of the actions. DNRs increased by 23 as unlicensed fraud continues, despite everything that everyone is trying to do in that regard. Investigative audits dropped by 53, as these audits grow increasingly more comprehensive and labor-intensive. We have a concentration of new audits coming from the Southern California regions, and we have been redirecting some of our audit resources from Northern California to the LA area to assist with the increase in those audit requests coming from enforcement. We have also performed 91 proactive random audits on high-risk business operations, which represents an increase of 38 such audits over the prior year. I am pleased to report that the department has also issued 15 bar orders in the first 9 months of 10-11, banning individuals from all real estate and related business activities as a result of their egregious behavior. With over 5,600 active investigations, we continue to look for ways to improve the outcome of our enforcement efforts and to leverage our available resources from the investigation through the audit and onto the hearing and potential disciplinary action. One of the more recent and noteworthy changes to our traditional investigative strategy is to address certain complaints up front, expediting the investigation through an advocacy program. During the 7 months of the pilot program, from which we ran the advocacy program, 140 cases were handled through that program. DRE has facilitated the return of $1,250,866 to consumers as a result of that program. In addition, there are many other instances of mediated disputes that were not monetary in nature but resulted in the successful resolution of the complaints. This concept has been so successful that it is now a permanent part of our operation. You may remember that we have been trying for some time to secure examination center facilities so that we can provide electronic exams statewide. We had good news for Southern California, with new leases just finalized last week for Los Angeles and San Diego. Once renovated to suit the needs of the electronic exam project, we plan to launch those exams in both these locations in the fall of this year. And in closing, we recently posted to our website a 2010 annual report, which summarizes our achievements that we've made during that year. This report, along with the strategic plan and other information, is available in the About DRE page of our website. This concludes my operations report today, and I am pleased now to introduce you to Mr. Bill Moran. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara, and good afternoon to everyone. The Department of Real Estate has been much more active in the area with criminal law enforcement agencies in recent years because the scope of real estate fraud schemes became more prevalent and damaging than our usual methods, which just involved disciplining real estate licensees or issuing desist and refrain orders to unlicensed individuals, are really not in and of themselves adequate to combat the problems that we were seeing. So today I'm going to follow up on a couple of criminal prosecutions that have stemmed from our investigations and are the results of our efforts to place more emphasis on reaching out and coordinating with criminal law enforcement agencies. The updates I'm about to provide are each in their own right a poster child for the type of activity that has led to the economic conditions that we all face today, which largely began in real estate and ultimately spread to the entire United States and world economies. Now, I should say that criminal cases do take some time to complete all the way through the trial phase. And so the actual activity in the first case that I will present dates all the way back to the year 2006. And many of you will remember the market conditions that existed at that time. In this case, we had a real estate broker who employed unlicensed loan representatives who knew all the tricks of the trade when it came to manufacturing information for straw buyers in connection with stated income loans. As was common in that era, mortgage loan brokers and borrowers submitted loan applications to lenders who didn't really care about the borrower's ability to repay and performed no review or underwriting procedures, knowing that they were simply going to sell the loans and pass them off to some other institution. And the secondary market didn't ask any questions either, and they simply packaged the loans into mortgage-backed securities and sold them to investors. In essence, everyone was greedy. And besides, with real estate values inflating at record levels, what could possibly go wrong? As it turns out, and as we all know, you and I and the entire country are the victims of this type of abuse that took place and many others like it. The group in this scheme essentially defrauded federally insured lenders. They recruited straw buyers with good FICO scores to purchase multiple properties. In order to qualify them for stated income loans, they falsified all of their employment and income information by using shell companies they controlled to report the false employment to lenders. A few examples that you will see in a video that I will play in a minute involves a nanny who essentially was reported as being an investment analyst making $9,000 a month. The second involved a landscaper who was reported as working as an investment analyst making $14,000 a month. Now, at the same time they were defrauding the lenders, they also defrauded the straw buyers into believing that they were entering into a business transaction wherein they would profit by assisting others to purchase homes they could not qualify for. In essence, they were doing a good deed, and they would be rewarded with a small stipend for their cooperation. And they further defrauded lenders by inflating the property values of all the homes they purchased. And many of you will remember back in 2005 and 2006, the offers that were circulating, which exceeded the actual listing price, with standalone addendums that directed the extra proceeds to be paid to a handyman of some sort or some other third party, and obviously eventually just ended up right back in the pockets of the organizers. So I want to show a brief video now that kind of describes this whole program and does a real good job of it.
These 20 homes, all of them located in Elk Grove, are at the center of our investigation.
I paid $416,000, $441,000, $437,000 for this house.
Walter Bakos and six other investors.
How many houses did you buy?
Five.
Five houses?
Yes.
Say a group of loan officers, mortgage brokers, and a real estate agent duped them into buying more than 20 homes.
He said, what we're looking for is people like you that have a good credit rating and that can purchase homes for individuals that need a home.
They would enter into a lease-to-own agreement. The tenants would make the mortgage payments, pay the taxes, and after 2 years, purchase the home for a 14 to 20% profit.
Did any tenants ever live in your home?
No.
Did any payments ever get made?
No.
Now they've been forced into foreclosure. The homes are all for sale. The banks are taking a tremendous loss, more than $9 million in loans. But how did a contractor, a retired nanny, and a group of average Joes qualify for all those loans?
Do you have that kind of money to buy two homes?
Definitely not, no.
Our investigation uncovered how this man, James Martin,
I have nothing to say,
and his business partners at VFM Investment Group
prefer that you speak to my lawyer.
Inflated the investors' incomes and lied on their loan applications so they could qualify for millions of dollars in loans.
You're saying they fudged your income?
Yes.
On your loan paperwork?
Mm-hmm.
What did they put down?
I think it's about $14,000 a month.
But that's not all we found. Jim Martin listed Pat Romano, a retired nanny, as a financial executive. On her loan application, he listed her as an employee of a company he owns, making $9,000 a month.
But you didn't work for James Martin.
No, never did. No, absolutely not.
Jim Martin also listed Tim McDaniel as an employee of VFM Investment Group. His loan application claims the landscaper is actually an investment analyst earning almost $13,000 a month.
So you never gave anybody permission to list you as an employee?
No.
You had no idea they listed you as an employee?
No.
So we asked Jim Wettick.
I've been with the Bureau for almost 35 years.
A retired FBI agent to review the results of our investigation.
Based on your experience, would you consider this blatant fraud?
Yes, I would.
So what's the incentive? Why would a loan officer or a mortgage broker lie on someone's application?
They inflate the figures. The bank loans the money. And with the inflated figures, they'll pay themselves fees.
Commissions.
And commissions.
And those loan applications are not the only figures that are inflated. Our investigation uncovered that Jim Martin and his business partners, Mario Fellini and Gabe Veramontis, inflated the value of every single house.
When this house hit the market, it listed for a little more than $400,000. But Walter Bakos wound up paying an additional $20,000. This one listed for $420,000, but Jeffrey Johnson paid almost $435,000.
By inflating the value of the houses, those involved increased their commissions by tens of thousands of dollars.
With those kind of figures, parties involved, estimated losses, you can expect probably the federal government will be interested in mounting an investigation, and someone will be prosecuted. I'm sure of it.
Okay, so obviously in this case, the Department of Real Estate took action, which resulted in revoked licenses for the corporation, Freedom Connect Capital Mortgage, Joseph Gallo, and another individual, Mario Fellini, surrendered his license. We also issued desist and refrain orders to James Martin and Gabriel Veramontes. But in addition to that, which is kind of our standard fare, we also coordinated with the FBI in an investigation that they conducted into the matter. And on September 20th, 2007, the U.S. Attorney's Office filed a federal indictment against all of the defendants that you've heard in this case. The indictment charged each of them with 14 counts of bank fraud, 18 counts of false statements and loan applications, 18 counts of conspiracy to launder funds, and 7 counts of mail fraud. Fast forwarding a few years, in March of 2011, the case was concluded. So as I said earlier, criminal cases do take some time. Almost all of the defendants in the case pled to some of the counts they were charged with in order to avoid going to trial. But one defendant, Gabriel Veramontes, chose to go to trial, and that trial was concluded by the jury verdict in March of 2011. In the end, he was convicted of 6 counts of mail fraud, 7 counts of bank fraud. He's scheduled to be sentenced on June 23, 2011, and he's facing a maximum sentence in federal prison of 30 years. And all I can say is, what I can say is he better hope the judge doesn't have either a home or a 401k account. And I have here, this is a picture of Gabriel Veramontes at the time the search warrants were executed. And in essence, he is now being held in custody without bail until his sentence occurs. And I just want to acknowledge real quickly Tricia Summers, who's now our Sacramento District Office Manager over the enforcement program, but at that time was an investigator, is the one that actually handled this case. She did outstanding work. So thank you. So I'm happy to report that also there are a number of local district attorney's offices that have begun prosecuting real estate cases. And that's welcome news for those of us who have struggled with this for many years. The Los Angeles District Attorney's Office recently prosecuted a case involving an individual by the name of Donald Marshall Otis, who in essence ran a foreclosure rescue scam. And he deceived a property owner who was in distress into deeding a property over into a trust in which the property owner was the beneficiary and Otis was the trustee. Under the terms of the agreement, the owner would be allowed to reside in the property until it was sold, at which time all of the proceeds were to go to him. But instead, Otis subsequently listed the property for sale and directed the payment of all the proceeds to go to him, his wife, and himself. The property owner received no proceeds from the sale. After a hearing, the DRE revoked Otis's license back in 2008. We also worked with the Long Beach Police Department in a criminal investigation and referred the matter to the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office for criminal prosecution. The DRE assisted the District Attorney's Office with their case and provided testimony at the criminal trial. In the end, the trial concluded in March of 2011. March was a very good month, by the way. And he was convicted of theft and other related charges and sentenced to 4 years and 8 months in state prison. He was also ordered to pay restitution of $235,000 to the victim and, this is good news, reimbursement to the Department of Real Estate in the amount of $3,700 for the cost of our investigation. Now, I understand that the going wage in state prison is about a dollar a day, so we're going to see if we can't maybe garnish that. But it'll take some time to get that money back. Second case I wanted to cover that's recently filed by our Sacramento District Attorney's Office against the operators of a loan modification company, which had a licensed broker and several unlicensed representatives. The DRE took their action in this case by filing a desist and refrain order against the unlicensed individuals, and the broker involved in the operation surrendered his license. But the good news in this case is that the Sacramento District Attorney's Office has issued arrest warrants for the culprits, and they included in their charges against them a violation of Section 10130 of the Business and Professions Code, which is acting as a real estate licensee without a license, and collecting advance fees in a loan modification transaction. As many of you know from some of our past presentations, since October 2009, collecting advance fees for loan modification transactions involving 1 to 4 unit residential properties is unlawful and carries a fine of up to $10,000 for an individual or $50,000 for a corporation and imprisonment for up to 1 year in county jail. So in addition to these cases that I've described, we have other criminal cases that have been filed recently in Riverside County, San Joaquin County, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, San Diego County, San Bernardino County, Tulare County, and others. So we are seeing more real estate-related prosecutions than I can remember at any time in the past, and this is welcome news and a positive development. One of the steps that we've taken recently to make the DRE more useful to prosecutors is to have our investigators, attorneys, and auditors obtain certifications that allow us to present hearsay testimony at criminal preliminary hearings. And what this does is it allows prosecutors to avoid putting on a mini trial at the preliminary hearing, and they can use our staff to summarize what we found during the investigation. What we had found in talking with prosecutors is that it was an impediment to our cases being filed, is that the DA could not use us in this capacity, which would force them to either call all of the witnesses that they had to a criminal preliminary hearing, and there they would have to show that the evidence they have is worthy to proceed on to trial. Not only was this time-consuming for everyone involved, but it also gives the defense attorney kind of two cracks at all of the witnesses and evidence in the case. Another alternative that DA had in the past, they would have to have a peace officer essentially redo our entire investigation so that the peace officer could then present the testimony at the preliminary hearing. So with these certifications, the district attorneys are far more receptive to our cases, and it adds additional tools to our arsenal, making us better able to deal with the very serious issues that we find in the real estate marketplace. We're currently scheduled to testify in 4 preliminary hearings throughout the state, and we hope to see more of it in the future, because we want to ensure that there are real consequences to real estate fraud. That concludes my remarks. At this time, I would like to introduce Tom Poole. And you heard his title. It's very long, but I think he's here today in his capacity as Assistant Commissioner over our Mortgage Loan Activities Unit. So thank you very much.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Tom Poole. I am here today in my capacity of manager over the Mortgage Lending Activity Section. We are going to talk about one of your favorite subjects, I know, and that is the Secure and Fair Enforcement Licensing Act of 2008. You have heard this presentation in various forms over the last few forums that we have given. I'm going to put a little different twist on it, and you're going to have to wait to the very end, so I don't want anybody leaving as to why this matters to you, all right? Just a quick introduction. You'll see on the over here that we've it says safe and shoulder tap compliance, and we're going to get into a little bit about what that means. Really, over the last 5 months, even though you've been hearing this for probably the last year and a half, maybe 2 years, about the coming of SAFE, we're only 5 months into the implementation of SAFE. We had a long ramp-up period, not only from a legislative process, but then getting resources and then ramping up to actually implement endorsements to real estate licenses in order for our real estate licensees to engage in mortgage loan origination activity. It was hard going, but we were very successful in November and December handling the crush of applications and getting those applications processed and MLO endorsements issued by the January 1st deadline. We had very few, if any, holdovers that had completed applications that we did not issue. So that was really round one. Now, as we get into this implementation over the last 5 months, there are some interesting consequences that go along with that, and I'm going to get into that. Just by way of background, real briefly, what is SAFE? SAFE is actually a federal mandate. It was put into law by H.R. 3231, which is about an 800-page bill. It didn't initially have SAFE in it. It was a last-minute amendment to the bill that was actually sponsored by Senator Feinstein. And it required all states to implement, it required mortgage loan originators to meet minimum standards. It also gave each state an option to pass their own law to implement the federal mandate. And in California, we did that with SB 36. Now, this was an important development for a number of reasons. Without SB 36, without getting the authority to regulate mortgage loan originators, that responsibility would have fallen to HUD. And I don't know about you, I must rather keep the authority for regulation at the state level as opposed to letting HUD come in and regulate the mortgage loan origination business. 36 gave us the authority to issue to our licensees mortgage loan originator endorsements. And the purpose behind SB 36 was to enhance consumer protections. Consumer protections were extended in a number of ways. For one, it created a national minimum standards for mortgage loan originators. In California, especially our DRE licensees that worked under as a mortgage broker in the state, the additional requirements were more the same as opposed to different, but many other states did not have any kind of standards for their mortgage loan originators. So this was a huge shift, at least from a national perspective, in terms of the paradigm in the requirements for mortgage loan originators. The other thing that it did, and it kind of leveled the playing field in California to a large degree. Those entities that were licensed by the Department of Corporations, and mostly your mortgage bankers under the Residential Mortgage Lending Act or the California Finance Lenders Law, they were licensed at the entity level, but not as the individual loan officers. What SB 36 did is require those individuals also to be licensed. And so they're more or less on par now with the originators that operate under a real estate license. It was a huge shift. The other thing SB 36 did was create a national database, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later in more detail, but what the database does allows consumers to go in and find out if their loan originator is, in fact, compliant with the requirements. What it also does, it gives regulators the authority, or at least a tool, to look at what originators have done or whether they've been disciplined in other states. One of the issues that came out of the mortgage meltdown really was the fact that we would license individuals, we'd discipline these individuals, and they would go off and go to work somewhere else. Oftentimes, they would go to work for a DOC company or a bank or something of that nature. What the database does, it doesn't matter where that mortgage loan originator worked. If they're disciplined in New Hampshire or Texas, they try to come into California, we're going to know their history. We didn't have that as a tool previously. So this is a very positive thing in terms of keeping the bad operators out of the business. The other thing that we're finding out, there's a lot of confusion about what is an MLO? What's the definition? Really, there's only three elements that cover most situations. One is anybody who takes a residential mortgage loan application. And it means just that. If you're sitting down and taking information down for 1003, and it's not even have to be on a regular form, but if you're getting information in order to complete the application process, that's one of the elements that is required to meet the test. The other is someone who negotiates the terms of a residential loan. And when I talk about negotiate, you need to look at that in the broadest possible sense. If you're talking terms and conditions of a loan, in order to get that person a loan, you are, by definition, negotiating that loan. The third thing that needs to be met is getting compensated. Again, compensation needs to be looked at in the broadest possible sense. It's, regardless of form or time of payment, it's not necessarily just getting a commission when the loan closes. So if you're getting compensated for taking a residential loan application or negotiating the terms, you may need an MLO. The other thing that we're finding, there's some confusion about what is a residential loan. Well, a residential loan is secured by a dwelling, and it's residential property. And the one thing absent in this definition is owner-occupancy. So these aren't just owner-occupied loans. These are residential loans secured by a dwelling, and it's 1 to 4 units. So those are really the elements of a mortgage loan originator in terms of its definition. If you meet those criteria, you need an endorsement on your real estate license. The endorsement goes to the real estate broker license or the salesperson's license if he or she is doing that activity. So it's just not like the broker getting the MLO and that flowing down to each of the salespersons. No, if you're engaged in that activity, you need to have that MLO endorsement. And in fact, if a salesperson is engaged in the activity, the broker, his or her employing broker, also needs that MLO for that real estate salesperson in order to engage in that activity. One quirk in the definition of MLOs is independent loan processors and underwriters. They are also caught up in the definition of MLO. This has created a quirk in the law to the extent that if you're doing underwriting and you're doing loan processing and you're doing it in a very narrow scope, that's not something that requires a real estate license. However, by definition, you are doing MLO activity. So we are losing 2,300 licensees a month. I did the math as Barbara was talking, since our peak in 2007. So maybe these loan processors and underwriters that now need real estate licenses to get their MLOs will help help with those debts. But it is a quirk in the law. And the other thing is the MLO is renewed annually. So we're coming up in November, December with a new challenge to get those MLOs renewed. All right. So let's look at some numbers. We have had 26,253 individuals apply for an MLO. We have had 6,862 corporations, companies, and sole proprietorships apply for an MLO. And the grand total in terms of endorsements that we've issued to date is 23,726. Make a note somewhere. Just put 24,000 in your head or write it down, because that's going to be a significant number as we go forward. All right. There was another portion of SB 36 that was deviated from the federal law, and that was a requirement for a mortgage loan activity notification. What this requires is every licensee that is engaged in mortgage loan activity as defined, meaning making, arranging, or servicing loans secured by residential 1-4 units, needs to notify the Department of Real Estate of such. This definition is beyond, although it overlaps, but it is beyond the requirements of the MLO definition. But number the key elements, making or arranging loans secured by real property, that overlaps with MLO activity. This requirement went into effect a year before the endorsement requirement. So you basically had 30 days, not basically, you had 30 days to notify the department of your activities once you engaged in those activities, and you have 30 days to notify the department once you are no longer engaged in those activities. And that notification came in the form of an electronic notification. You go to our website. There's an MLO tab on our homepage. It would direct you how to complete the notification. The penalties, not only license discipline, perhaps license revocation, this is one of the few sections in the real estate law that allows the department to issue fines. So there's fines potentially up to $10,000 for noncompliance of the loan for failing to provide the notification. Well, guess what? It seemed to work pretty good. We received over 40,000 notices. I think we're up to 42,000 notices. So what's wrong with this picture? We received 40,000 notices of people saying, hey, we're in the mortgage loan origination business. And what number did I tell you to remember? 24,000. Well, that's interesting. So we have a group of folks out there that had told us and certified that they're in the business, but we only have 24,000 people that have gone through the process. I like to call this notification inconsistency, all right? What has occurred is basically we have about 15,000 licensees that have filed a notice with us that have declared that we're in the mortgage business, that we're doing mortgage loan origination activity, but we have no record of them ever applying in the NMLS, which is the Nationwide Mortgage Licensing System and Registry, and that's where you go to start the MLO process. Well, that's problematic. So we have another group that's less problematic. We got about 3,800 folks that have started the NMLS process but haven't filed their 866, and we're going to be addressing these folks and making sure that they file their 866 before we issue that endorsement. So, I talked about Operation Shoulder Tap. So that's what we're going to do with these 15,000 people that that already told us perhaps they're violating law. Now, I run in interesting circles, and I have a lot of friends that work for the ABC, Alcohol Beverage Control. And what they do on occasion, they go into an establishment that serves alcohol, and they look around, and they look at the younger patrons. And they go up to, they wouldn't do this if Bill, but they do something like this if Bill was young. Tap them on the shoulder and say, can we see your ID? We're checking for compliance, all right? And so we want to make sure the patron is in compliance. We want to make sure the proprietor is in compliance. And so they often do these shoulder tap operations. Well, I borrowed that from my friends over at ABC, and we are going to do the same thing. And this shoulder tap is going to be virtual, at least to begin with. We're going to start with emails and letters. All right? If you or somebody you know gets one of our emails that said, hey, you filed this 866, but you haven't got your MLO endorsement, you need to get a hold of the Department of Real Estate. All right? So this is this process has begun, and we're going to try to get people in compliance. That's our number one focus in the beginning. Non-responses to our emails and letters, we're going to tap a little harder. All right? This is going to result in broker office survey audits, and then out of those audits and broker office surveys, we fully intend to start disciplinary actions against these licensees. If we can establish that they are, in fact, engaged in activities that they're not licensed for. Now, these disciplinary actions can run the gamut from a desist and refrain order. Usually when you serve this on someone, you say it's a DNR, they think it's do not resuscitate, they get a little nervous. And we have to explain, no, it's a desist and refrain order just to stop your activity. We don't want to have any heart attacks. Then accusations is the next step, which could lead to a license revocation. And then we do have this ability to fine if we find out that they haven't noticed this properly. All right. What does this mean for all of you? All right. I know that many in this room are not specifically engaged in mortgage loan originations, but we're finding, as we move forward, some quirky things that are occurring. One of the things you need to do and encourage your clients to do is to check out your originator to make sure they're properly endorsed or they have registered and can do mortgage loan origination. What we're finding, and this is mostly coming from the MLOs that are trying to get their endorsements approved, but the lenders are actually verifying. They're looking at the 1003s, who originated it, who signed it, and what company are they from. If they can't verify that MLO status or endorsement, they're not funding a loan. And this is, I've gotten a number of calls from folks that said, you need to approve my MLO because I'm not going to get paid. And I said, well, that's horrible. What's your name and your address? So this is something that, yeah, we'll add them to the list. So this is something, as you go into a transaction, especially as we move forward into where the MLO becomes more of a standard, I want to encourage you and your clients to make sure that you go to the DRE license lookup. You're probably all familiar with it, right? You go in there and you punch in the name of a company or person and you can find out their license status. And what we have done with our licensing database, this is what it looks like, the screen that pops up when you want to check the status of a real estate license. And this is what pops up in the public information. And it has the typical, you know, this person's a broker, the license ID number. And it also, where that big yellow arrow is pointing to, the NMLS ID. This is your clue that this person is compliant and they have their MLO endorsement and, in fact, can originate loans. I picked on Mr. Trent, Peter Michael Trent. I hope he's not here today. No. Actually, Mr. Trent was the first recipient of an endorsement. So kudos to him. He was an early bird, took care of business. So, but this is what it looks like. If you don't see this NMLS number on the license record, no bueno, all right? You cannot use this person to originate that loan if they are operating under a real estate broker's license. Now, I did mention, for example, that DOC is now originating or giving licenses to mortgage loan originators. In those instances, if you know it's a mortgage banker, a non-depository lender, and an individual working for that company, they're licensed through the Department of Corporations. Department of Corporations, if you go to their website, they're going to refer you to this. The nationwide mortgage licensing system and registration consumer access page. And this is where you would go to verify other types of originators that aren't licensed by the DRE. If they are licensed by the DRE, I strongly encourage you to use our website, because this is website's a little more difficult to navigate. It does get you there, but it's more difficult. So going forward, this is something I want to plant in everybody's head. Help us achieve compliance, and then this will help you with transactions falling apart and getting these desperate calls from you all saying, can you just approve this guy's MLO so we can get this deal closed? Lastly, I just want to leave you with a couple of resources. We have an awful lot of information on the DRE's website. Many of you, since you're not interested in the MLO with respect to getting licensed, but we do have a lot of information about the endorsements and requirements. On our website, there's a tab that says MLO on our home site. And the other, as I pointed out, was the NMLS&R. You can also get there if you use a web search like Google or Bing or something, and just put in NMLS. And every time I try it, it's the first website that pops up. So with that, that concludes my remarks, and thanks for hanging with me. Now I have the distinct pleasure to introduce a good friend of mine, and I refer to him around the office as the Uber Auditor. So let me introduce Dan Sondre, our Chief of Audits.
Thank you, Tom, and good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. I have a couple of audit case stories for you today, and both teach lessons. Understand that most audit cases are cases that are not as exciting as those you'll hear about here. Typical is a case where we find some violations, the violations are corrected, and everyone benefits. As an auditor, though, you can't help but find such cases, such as the two that follow, to be a little more intriguing than the average audit case. The first audit case, called Something to Hide, Justice Delayed, involved a broker, R. Perez. Mr. Perez used multiple fictitious business names, including Excel Mortgage, Globe Financial Unlimited, RNA Associates, and other names. His business activities included mortgage loan, property resale, and broker escrow, and he had been licensed since 1985. Which brings us to our first attempt at auditing the records of Mr. Perez. The department received a complaint from a property seller who had sold her property using Mr. Perez as a listing agent and the escrow holder. This seller complained to the DRE that she had received two closing statements, each showing money was due her, but in different amounts, and as proceeds and no proceeds from the sale had come for a few months after the closing. That is a red flag, obviously. So an audit was ordered by our enforcement section, and the audit commenced in April of 2007, and many delays ensued. So, for example, the phone numbers on Mr. Perez's business cards were incorrect. Another phone number found had a full mailbox. But eventually, the auditor got a hold of Mr. Perez by phone and set up an appointment and sent a confirmation letter to him. When the auditor showed for the audit appointment, as scheduled a week later, she was told that Mr. Perez was out of town. Perez had left an after-hours phone message on the auditor's work phone, canceling the appointment. This is a tactic encountered during the course of audits. So when the auditor shows the next day at the office, those in the office seem stunned, and the auditor is told that he or she shouldn't be there because the broker says he called you. And so another audit appointment was scheduled a week later. 3 days before the new appointment, a letter arrived from an attorney stating that he was representing Mr. Perez and would be available in a month to a month and a half to work with the auditor. So a subpoena for records was prepared, listing all records that are to be provided a month hence, and the subpoena was served on Mr. Perez. On the appointed day, no records whatsoever were provided by Perez. Now, why would you not want to provide records to a nice DRE auditor? And so began the records chase necessary to find out what was happening with the accounts of Mr. Perez. Unfortunately, a failure to provide records is not an uncommon thing for the department. It is important that we actively pursue records, especially when there are indications that money is missing. So the DRE sent the case to the Attorney General to have them represent us in court to compel Mr. Perez to produce records. A year after the audit delay, on 7/31/08, the Superior Court in Los Angeles issued an order compelling compliance with the administrative subpoena ducis tecum. On the next day, our enforcement deputy served Mr. Perez with a copy of the order, and a month later, our auditor was back out there. So as some background, Mr. Perez negotiated some loans funded by institutional lenders. He did about 10 sales per year and handled 5 escrows with the volume of $1.3 million in receipts over a 2-year period. It wasn't a big operation. And so the audit began. In spite of the court order, many accounting and other records were not provided. This was not a shocking development, by the way. Of course, many reasons were given for this failure to provide records. The computer and storage had crashed, and the assistant said records were irretrievable. Regarding canceled checks and deposit slips, Perez had put them away when he cleaned the office, but somehow he couldn't pull them back out. Regarding receipts and disbursement records, an employee didn't record the transactions properly. And regarding separate records for each beneficiary and bank account reconciliations, an employee took some of the files, and the files in the computers were burglarized from Perez's main office. A police report reporting the burglary was later provided to the auditor. And for your information, this too is not an infrequent turn of events in audit cases. For some reason, and I always ask, you know, why would somebody steal accounting records? It happens frequently. However, enough records were provided to allow the auditor to reconstruct what had happened. First, Perez maintained two accounts for escrow trust fund handling. And the audit found that Perez had a trust fund shortage of $182,307. And that was due to things such as unauthorized disbursements of $147,622, negative escrow balances of $4,875, bank charges of $101, unidentified causes of $29,709. And that's a fail in the trust fund handling. So here's a summary of what composed the $147,622 unauthorized disbursements. As you can see, it seems that many people who worked for or with Mr. Perez were bestowed with trust funds. The escrow coordinator, a salesperson, the escrow officer, Perez's son, and of course, Perez himself. Much of the money to Perez was taken in the form of cash withdrawals, and he admitted to taking the money for personal use in a written statement. These transfers, withdrawals, and disbursements were all either made by Perez or by the escrow officer. With regard to the complainant seller, the audit also revealed that funds of the seller complaining that totaling over $87,000 were among the missing trust funds. And they were actually surprised because the statements they received didn't show that much. But, and Perez ended up refinancing his home a year later to repay the seller. So the seller did get their money back. At the end of the audit, Perez was cited for 21 different violations of the real estate law and the regulations. And so here's a timeline of events in the R. Perez case. The first audit attempt started in May 2007. The second audit commenced in September 2008 and was completed in November 2008. And our enforcement and legal sections acted quickly, such that an accusation was filed in early December 2008. And so what happened? On September 15, 2009, after an administrative hearing, Mr. Perez's broker license was revoked. And that was the end of the real estate story for him. Okay, and now we have a second case, and we'll call this one fleecing the broker, or lack of supervision plus a signature stamp equals trouble. This case involved a routine audit of a corporate licensee who did property management, managing 262 properties for 231 owners. The company collected $2.4 million in trust funds annually. On the first day of the entrance an entrance conference was held with the designated officer and the longtime chief financial officer. The corporation used four trust accounts, and the DO and the unlicensed CFO were the only signers on each of them. The CFO was also in charge of the corporate accounts and the accounts of a related maintenance company, which was used for property maintenance. And now, one of the things that will make the hair on the back of the neck of an auditor stand is the following statement by a broker at the beginning of an audit. And that is, before we get started, I have something important to tell you. In this case, the designated officer said something like that, except for he said that the chief financial officer had something very important to discuss at the beginning. And so, at the start of the audit, the CFO, who had worked for the broker for 15 years, admitted to the auditor in the entrance conference that she had taken $61,000 in trust funds. The CFO had told the designated officer about this embezzlement after the DRE auditor had called to schedule the routine audit. And incidentally, we've worked on other cases where the bookkeeper just doesn't even show up on the first day of the audit or any day thereafter, and the broker's left wondering why, and the auditor's going, uh-oh. So, during this audit, the CFO admitted to the auditor of taking an additional $15,000 from another trust account. And since the CFO had signature control and accounting control, and she could take funds and hide the taking of funds without detection. What is always interesting, and as an aside, isn't financial crime always interesting as long as it doesn't happen in your house? What is interesting is how the CFO accomplished the embezzlement. The CFO set up two phony properties with two fake tenants, one named Carla Taylor and the other Mary Fleece. Mary Fleece, that's pretty bold, isn't it? The CFO also set up a phony landscaping company that had a business address that was the same as her residence. And the CFO would write checks to herself and to her mortgage lender using the designated officer's signature stamp, and would then account for the transaction as a property cost transaction, you know, saying it was expended for something else. And the CFO would also write checks to her phony landscaping company, purportedly for work done, and use this as a means of stealing money. The CFO also supplemented the trust account by depositing money from the corporate broker's related maintenance company. And this actually represents more money lost to the broker, as the trust fund shortage would have been larger if that wasn't in the account. So. The CFO was able to run reports with or without the phony properties, depending on what was needed. And in this case, there was no supervisory review of the records, of transactions, or of use of the signature stamp. There was also no reconciliation of records, and there was no supervisory review of the records to the bank statement. There were some policy and procedures in place for supervision, but they were inadequate, and they were not followed and complete as they are, as they were. So the designated officer had become too comfortable with the work of his trusted CFO. So what was the result of this? During the audit, the horrified designated officer deposited $80,000 to the trust accounts to correct the shortage. The CFO was to pay him back. Given the cooperation of the designated officer during the examination and correction of the shortage, perhaps the sophistication of the CFO's scheme and his indirect complicity in the shortage, the corporation and the designated officer received restricted licenses on terms and conditions, including being subject to paying for the audit and for a chargeable follow-up audit. And it was a very expensive lesson for the designated officer.